Possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including International Galleries, Weber and Thies Law Offices, and ABC Billiards, an authorized Brunswick dealer specializing in pool tables, custom cues, and game room furniture. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. 200 products bear her name. Her name appears on cookbooks and recipe booklets. At the height of her popularity, she received thousands of letters every day. Who is she? She is a non-existent woman, Betty Crocker. Our guest on the Afternoon Magazine today is Susan Marks. She is the author of a biography, if you will, of Betty Crocker. The title, Finding Betty Crocker, The Secret Life of America's First Lady of Food. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Susan Marks' interest in Betty Crocker began while she worked as a tour guide for the Minnesota Historical Society. It led her to write her master's thesis on Betty Crocker. She also developed it into a documentary film project, and now this book, Finding Betty Crocker, The Secret Life of America's First Lady of Food. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. Susan will be in the Chicago area later this month on Tuesday, April 19th, that's next week, at noon. She'll be in Winnetka at the bookstall for a program called Lunch and Learn. And then later in the day, on Tuesday, April 19th, 2005, at 7:30 in the evening, she'll be in Oak Brook at Borders Books and Music for an event there. 333-9455, the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Susan, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. When you were a tour guide for the Historical Society and you talked with people about Betty Crocker, what did they ask? Did they ask a lot of questions about her?
Yeah, it was sort of interesting. I was giving tours, like you mentioned, of the Milling District, Betty's birthplace, and I noticed that whenever I spoke of Betty, people would automatically smile, whether they thought it was silly or whether they had a great nostalgic connection. But more often than not, people would tell me stories about Betty Crocker. They would tell me how they won a Betty Crocker scholarship program or that they had their grandmother's Betty Crocker picture cookbook, or maybe that they had heard once upon a time how controversial her cake mix were. And I'll be honest with you, at first it was a little lost on me. I didn't really get it. Why was everyone so excited about Betty Crocker, and why did everybody seem to have a sort of reaction to her? But the more I gave tours, the more I realized there was a lot more to the story than meets the eye. One that's sort of a phenomena, if you will, that people will look past all of the commercial motives behind her and make an emotional connection with her. And so I devoted the next 6 years to researching and writing about Betty.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? She's a spokeswoman. She's a saleswoman. And her bottom line really is the bottom line for General Mills. So what do you suppose it is about Betty Crocker that people have connected with her for so many years?
Well, I think at different times it was different things. And so since she was invented, created, if you will, in 1921, her purpose was really, you know, like you said, the bottom line, to sell flour. But it was also an extension of the company. A lot of people were writing to Washburn Crosby Company, which later became General Mills, asking baking and cooking questions, real basic questions. And they felt that they had to respond to them, and that's why they came up with Betty Crocker, this fictitious woman to answer this mail. And from there, she really developed, and people started corresponding with her quite a bit, so much so that the Washburn Crosby Company decided, well, we'll give our home service staff, our home economists, their own cooking show under the name of Betty Crocker. And that took off right away, first in Minneapolis and later all over the United States. And that stayed on the air for almost 30 years. So the need she was fulfilling was sort of company in some sense, that she was company to women who were home. And, you know, of course she was answering cooking and baking questions, but anything else, you know, or I should say nothing was off topic. So people would ask her questions and advice about anything, maybe romance, raising kids, balancing a budget, these sort of things. So for a while, she was sort of a friend to homemakers. And of course, that changed over the years, too. Once we get into the post-war era and into the more of a changing role of women, you see her less and less associated with a consumer and a little bit more of a brand.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon about Betty Crocker with Susan Marks. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Indiana, line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, it's taking me back to being at my grandmother's knee.
Mm-hmm.
I got, you know, I'm sure the cultural historians are going to start wrapping out PhD theses like crazy on Betty Crocker and all the things you can do with it. And that's where my questions aim. Number one, forgetting things, I think her facial appearance changed throughout time.
Oh, yeah.
And I want to know if you could talk about that. And actually, if you could date it, that would help me on some memories, you know, relates to other things that would, you know, tell me how old I was then. And the second thing is, if I'm not mistaken, there was Betty Crocker that occasionally did little ads on radio. And I wondered if that were true, whether or not, do you know who that person was or persons that did it?
And, oh, yes.
Okay, those are the, you know, I got 1,000 more, but I'll wait till PhDs come out, I guess. Thanks.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Good questions.
Yes, they are really good. Well, first of all, about radio and actually television, quite a few different actresses played Betty Crocker at different times. And even the director of the Betty Crocker Kitchen read her own scripts over the radio at times. So a couple of different women played her, but there was one woman in particular that really stood out, and her name was Adelaide Holley, and she was an actress and a scholar. And she was just, I don't know how to say this, other than adorable. She would come on the air, both the radio and television, and people just really thought she was Betty Crocker. She said she was Betty Crocker. Why not?
Mm-hmm.
And she just had this sort of warmth about her, and no one seemed to mind the fact that she had blonde hair. And Betty was never portrayed in her portraits, which I'll get to in a moment, but she was never portrayed as a blonde. And here she was on television, even in black and white, you can see that her hair is very blonde. No one seemed to mind. They just liked her portrayal of Betty Crocker so much. And getting back to her portraits, that's an interesting phenomenon. All advertising characters change, all of them. But Betty's is particularly interesting because she was supposed to represent her market, the people who bought her products, used her recipes. So just really briefly, she had many unofficial portraits starting in 1920, probably 22. But in 1936, she got her first official portrait, and that set the stage for all the Betty Crockers, red and white, which she'll be wearing in all of her portraits. And this was painted by Nathan McMean, which she was a very popular illustrator at the time. And she is supposedly, at least the Betty Crocker lore goes, that she was a combination of all the women who worked for the Betty Crocker kitchen that the artist took. a nose here and eyes here and eyebrows there and created this, the quintessential Betty. She got her next portrait update in 1955, and this is the grandmother Betty. She looks older, grayer hair, a little ruddier complexion, and this is the one that people seem to love the most. The next one is the 1965 Betty Crocker, and by the way, these are all on the cover of my book.
Mm-hmm.
In 1965, she's wearing pearls, and she looks about 20 years younger. Some people say she looks a lot like Jackie Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1969, she got another update that looks quite a bit like the 65 one, but I've heard people say that this one looks like Mary Tyler Moore.
Hmm.
And then in 1972, she got another portrait update. Now, these are looking less and less like people who spend time at home in the kitchen and more like people who spend time in the boardroom,
mm-hmm.
as it were. And this Betty Crocker, I've been told, looks quite a bit like Lady Bird Johnson. I personally thought it looked like my mother. She has very, very stunning blue eyes. And then let's see, her next portrait was in 1980, and she's looking a little bit more casual. And then we have another portrait update, I believe it's 86. I don't know if I've left any out here, where she's wearing a great big bow that some people have said would be a fire hazard in the kitchen. And for the first time ever, she has green eyes. And then in 1996, she got her brand new portrait update. That's the one that's with us today. And it is a combination of the faces of the 75 women who made up the Spirit of Betty Crocker contest for her 75th anniversary. So all of their features were morphed into one computer composite and then painted by an artist, John Engel. For the first time ever, Betty has brown eyes and darker skin to reflect the cultural diversity of her market. And I've heard some people say they've even called her La Latina Betty.
Mm-hmm. Now, for the first time since 1955, when we had that grandmotherly Betty Crocker with a little bit the wisps of gray hair at the temples, she's smiling. She's showing some teeth.
Yes.
And also in this portrait, her clothing is slightly more relaxed. It's not casual, but
right.
It's more relaxed. She looks like she could be a working mom, but ready to take the kids to soccer.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned her smile. Well, for the first time since 1955, she is showing teeth. For many years, she's sort of smiling, but not fully as she is now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is really reflective of what was going on in the world, in particular during the Vietnam War years, Betty's not smiling. And then after that, it seems like there's a little bit of an uneasiness of the role of women and what they're supposed to look like and how they're supposed to behave. And that's extremely controversial. So it seemed like there's a little bit of a struggle, a little bit of gray area of this idea of how to portray the quintessential woman. And I imagine that's a difficult thing for anyone to do, let alone a company.
Yeah. How has the latest Betty Crocker portrait been received, this portrait unveiled in 1996?
Well, it was very well received. Certainly not everybody loved it, but overall people thought it was great. They thought it was a great cultural sort of, I guess what I've read the most is they're saying that it was a great cultural combination, that Betty wasn't just white anymore, and that perhaps that she was a culinary ambassador into the cultural world of multi-diversity. But there were some people who didn't like it at all. They thought, you know, I'm a man. I use the Betty Crocker products. I use Betty Crocker's cookbook. And I'm not represented in that portrait. So you can understand why some people thought, it doesn't really work for me. But it must have worked for enough people, and I would say it got more positive feedback than anything else.
Yeah. Now, has General Mills ever thought of giving Betty a male counterpart?
You know, I don't know. I don't know if they have. It's been sort of been behind closed doors. I know certainly journalists suggested it, that maybe there should be a Bob Crocker.
Betty and Bob Crocker. Okay.
but I think we all saw how that worked for Barbie. You know, Ken was always in her shadow. And so I don't know how well that would ever work for a Bob Crocker.
Yeah. Now, does Betty Crocker have a biography? Is there, you know, or was she always about just providing advice?
I think that, well, that's an excellent question. I think that, yes, she was always about providing advice, but that was never enough. people wanted to know more about her. And you can see this happening certainly with the director of the Betty Crocker Kitchens for almost 20 years. It was the height of Betty's popularity in the 30s and 40s. That woman, her name was Marjorie Child Husted, but everybody called her Betty Crocker. There was this need to sort of associate a live woman with the name. And so when Marjorie Husted went to Hollywood in the 1930s to interview Hollywood stars as Betty Crocker, everyone continued to call her Betty Crocker and associate her with Betty Crocker to the extent that their personalities kind of became intertwined. And I think that this worked out very, very well for everybody, except then at some point, Marjorie Husted moved on. And then who was the next Betty Crocker? And so it became a sort of thing where any director of the Betty Crocker Kitchens was called Betty Crocker.
Hmm, that's interesting. You know, the radio program began in the 20s, mm-hmm. correct? On WCCO in Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Yes.
And it wasn't too long when other stations picked up the program. But this was interesting. Every station had a different woman appearing as Betty Crocker. They all read the same script, but every station had a different woman. That was really smart, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it was especially ingenious considering that these national networks had yet to be established. So it was still in the really early stages of radio back in 1924 and 25. But by the time that these different networks became established, it became a little bit easier to broadcast over several states. So then they needed less and less Bettys over the years.
Yeah. But Betty could be, she could be your hometown friend because she would sound like you sounded. If you were in Boston or if you were in Chicago or if you were in the South, she would sound like your neighbor.
Exactly.
Right?
It was really quite clever, but it was also so necessary. But it really helped Betty become this person that everybody wanted her so badly to be.
Hmm. What was her radio persona like in the beginning?
Well, it was interesting. It certainly developed over time, but in the beginning, the rhetoric was a little bit like the domestic science home economic movement, where the idea was that, it was your job to get in there, your job as a woman, to get in there and cook and to do it well, and that you should feel empowered by what you do, and your job is very important, and you are exactly where you need to be, cooking for your husband and for your family. And certainly Betty didn't come up with this idea. This is very much of the time period. And that certainly evolved over the years, but there was always this idea in her radio broadcast that food and love are very closely connected, and that if you work very hard at putting love into your food, or if you into the food you create, or if you work very hard at creating a happy atmosphere and serving this healthful food for your family, that you will in return get love back from your family, and that you should feel empowered by what you're doing.
Hmm. Now, there were other radio programs that dealt with housekeeping. The Department of Agriculture had a radio program. This radio station, years and years and years ago, when it went on the air in the 1920s, it had a program or programs about housekeeping. Were they similar to Betty Crocker's program, or was her program somehow dramatically different, significantly different?
Well, I would say at first they were all very similar, and Betty was the first to have her own radio show. I do believe it was Aunt Sammy with the U.S. government had put out. But, it's difficult to tell because some records weren't kept. But they all helped pioneer this sort of format where it was a show that was geared towards women, but everybody knew more than women were listening. And it was to help out with any domestic needs, and it might be sponsored by a product or company, or it might not be. And Betty was similar in that sense to all of her sisters, but she was dissimilar in some ways because she had her own cooking show, cooking school, where you could listen and try out the recipe, try out the lesson, and you could mail in the results back to Betty Crocker and get a diploma back and even do an on-air ceremony. You did, by the way, have to make sure that you had get the grocer's signature on your report form that said that you had only used gold medal flour. And her radio format really just evolved as it needed to, as because Betty Crocker staff knew that, you know, recipes alone were not enough. People wanted more. They wanted human interest stories. They wanted something sort of compelling, even controversial. So they started these other programs throughout the 30s where it's more of a talk show format, where Betty Crocker would interview bachelors and bachelorettes about what they were looking for in a husband or wife and what they would do to secure a happy future and, of course, what was their favorite food. And she even, like I mentioned before, went to Hollywood and interviewed Hollywood stars about balancing life on film and off film and what were their favorite recipes. And so these were immensely popular, and this helped contribute to this mail volume that Betty received, which was just phenomenal. In the height of her popularity, she got anywhere between 4,000 to 5,000 letters per day.
Yeah.
And some of them had nothing at all to do with gold medal flour.
And she wrote back.
Yes, yes. Every single letter. There was a policy at General Mills that every single letter sent to Betty Crocker was returned. And even my own grandmother wrote a letter to Betty Crocker back in 1950, and Betty, of course, wrote back.
Yeah. How did she respond to letters that were of a, you know, kind of a letter that somebody today might send to Ann Landers?
Yeah, the sensitive letters. Those were given special concern, especially when Marjorie Husted was the director. She would take those letters home, actually. Anything that was sensitive, sort of sad, and I've included some of those in my book, and give them their own special response. Those were not returned in a form letter form at all. And I actually have talked to and interviewed several former home economists that said that, you know, many of the letters were very simple to answer and that anyone could do it. But if there was any question, they would pass those along to the director so that she could, you know, make sure that she gave very sound advice. And sometimes some of that advice was that I think you need help above and beyond what Betty Crocker can do. And maybe you need to talk to your clergy. Maybe you need to talk to your doctor. Maybe you need to talk to your family. These sort of things were not uncommon.
Yeah. Marjorie Husted, we mentioned her a couple of times now. Was she responsible for writing the scripts for the Betty Crocker radio program?
For a long time, yes.
Yeah.
Sometimes her responsibilities were just too weighty and she couldn't do everything, but she certainly did that for a while, and she even broadcast for a while on WCCO radio. So her role was really all things to all people, which, as we all know, is an extremely difficult role to be in, but she did it quite well for 20 years, and by all accounts, she was no Betty Crocker herself. She was a very, very well-educated, very strong-minded businesswoman who knew that if Betty Crocker were to be or to stand apart from her competitors, she had to have a compassionate level, and she had to continue to listen to what people were saying to Betty Crocker in their letters and then respond to that appropriately.
Mm. How are the scripts developed?
Well, many times they were developed just by the idea of either a product like gold medal flour or Bisquick, or a season, a time of the year. Like certainly around the springtime, they might talk about spring recipes, and we might not associate cakes with different times of year, but I guess once fresh fruit became available, then more of the sponge cakes where you could put fresh fruit on it, those are the ones that were parts of these scripts. And sometimes the scripts came from letters that women would write about a special problem they were having. Like, let's say, for example, people were having problems with another baked good, and she would talk about all the different kinds of letters she got in and all the possible pitfalls that could come with different recipes. So there was a variety of different ways, but those were a couple of ways that were really powerful.
Hmm. What would you like to say about how the recipes were developed, the test kitchens, the service kitchens of Betty Crocker and General Mills?
This is a really interesting part of Betty Crocker's legacy that's often overlooked. And I personally got to know Betty not really through the kitchen as much as I did as a historian through the archives at General Mills, but I've had the opportunity to try many recipes and got to learn what it was like to not have any idea how to bake something, for example, maybe a chiffon cake, and to have to follow the recipe step by step perfectly to have it turn out. And one of the principles of the testing that went on at Washburn Crosby Company and later General Mills was that they wanted the recipes to be like a family recipe that was passed down generation to generation with all of the possible pitfalls and bugs worked out of them. And so they developed something called triple testing, as well as kitchen tested. And what this basically all means is that there was these rigorous tests they would put every recipe through. And some examples of this is they would have a recipe that they would try and put too much water in or not enough water in, or the stove would be too hot or not hot enough, or the oven would be at the wrong temperature, or the pan size would be different than what was suggested in the recipe. And then they would try all these different ways of making the recipe so it could accommodate all these different possible pitfalls. And then also they would send it to home testers who would test them in their own homes to see if they liked them. Now, let's say they didn't. Like, let's say the recipe did not work out. Well, they didn't just throw it away. They just filed it away, and then they would use that data again when they tested a recipe that was similar to it, or maybe they would revive that one of those old recipes to figure out why it didn't work.
Yeah. Well, last night I went to my collection of cookbooks, and I pulled out Betty Crocker's cookbook that goes back to the late 60s. I don't know how I came to acquire this, but I used it for a long time when I was a young woman and just learning to cook. And it's interesting how to look at the book and to see the care that they've taken in terms of showing you equipment and showing you techniques in drawings and photographs. Was that part of the Betty Crocker approach from the beginning?
Yeah, and it was because I got so many letters from people saying, what do you mean cream? I don't understand that, if there was a recipe that said that they had to cream shortening or cream eggs or something of that nature. So they had to really step everything back as if it was your first time in the kitchen and that there might be words that you're not familiar with, phrases, cooking techniques. So they would supply all of that in the Betty Crocker Picture Cookbook that originally came out in 1950. So it was sort of a primer in many ways for the new brides that was the well was often advertised. But then you might forget something. So it was also served, the cookbook also served as a reminder to how to go about a certain technique. But they didn't want to bore the more experienced cooks, so they would often have a key recipe that might be just something quite simple, but you could use that basis of that recipe with several other different options to make a pretty elaborate meal, and it may have nothing to do with baked goods at all. It might have something to do with more preparing a full meal with maybe different courses or maybe many dishes for entertaining and things of that nature. So they really tried to accommodate all levels of cook.
Yeah. I think one of the interesting things too in this cookbook, looking back at it now, it's all yellowed and it's stained, is that anyone who can read can make these recipes. But as you say, there are things in here that would appeal to someone who had a little bit more skill in the kitchen, although they're still straightforward and very easy. But I mean, you know, Cherry's Jubilee, I mean, many of these things, I would imagine, were not common recipes or common things that people would have day to day, you know, on the table.
Right, right. I thought that was interesting, too, when I went through it. Things that I couldn't even pronounce, things I hadn't even heard of before, would be right along some of these comfort foods that we think of, like spaghetti and meatballs or
applesauce.
Yeah. And so it really it covered the full gamut, and I think that that's pretty impressive. And I've talked to so many cooks and so many culinary historians, people just interested in this, and they say that certainly there's a lot of really fantastic cookbooks out there, but if you have the Betty Crocker Picture Cookbook in any of its editions, chances are you've got some really wonderful recipes to work with that are going to turn out and that are good advice if they come from a flower company or anybody else.
Yeah. Also, in the back of the book, special helps, a section on special help, special food terms. So if you didn't know what antipasto was, or bisque, or a blintz, or a chutney.
You could just look it right up.
A cookie, crepes, and on it goes. I think that's pretty interesting. Also in here, very basic things like how to set the table or how to set up a buffet.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that for some people, they grew up knowing these things, but for many people, they did not grow up knowing necessarily where the fork or the spoon should go, and certainly wanted to keep up appearances, so this is one way that they could do it, the right way to do it, you know, the way Betty Crocker said.
This is The Afternoon Magazine, and our guest this afternoon is Susan Marks. She is the author of Finding Betty Crocker, The Secret Life of America's First Lady of Food. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. We mentioned radio, and, you know, that was was a big technological change that came along in American homes in the 1920s. Something else that was happening, wood-burning and coal-burning stoves were being replaced with gas and electric ranges. And that had to have been a great opportunity for Washburn Crosby's Betty Crocker to be of help as well.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that is really significant in the development of Betty Crocker's early persona. These questions that a young bride or a person might have when they're starting out on their own, mother couldn't necessarily answer those questions. Like if you're going off an old recipe and it calls for a quick stove, well, that's referring to a wood or coal-burning stove. And if you've got a gas stove in front of you or electric one, you might not know what the temperature setting is. And then also food was changing. This is where we start to see, in this era of the 1920s, after World War I, we start to see a lot more processed food for the first time. So it was almost a new set of tools that women were working with. And even though we love the image of the flapper from the 1920s as this liberated woman who didn't give a care about the kitchen, that's sort of a myth. Certainly that happened. There were women like that, but for the majority of women, they still got married and they still found themselves in the kitchen very far away from their mother and didn't necessarily know how to cook for their husband the way they were expected. And that's where Betty Crocker stepped in. And it worked in the sense that women wrote back to her saying, "Thank you. That recipe did work, and my husband did like it, and I liked it too. And could you send me another recipe? And how about a recipe booklet? And I love your radio show. I find it very helpful, and I love the way you slowly give out the recipe, and so I can follow easily while I'm listening to you."
Hmm. Also, she was a great help through the difficulties of the Depression in World War II during rationing.
Yeah, that's, I think, where Betty became sort of alive, if you will. You know, she wasn't a real woman, but yet, through those years, she really seemed like one. The Depression was an interesting era for Betty because, from what we know about that era, it was such a difficult time for people who were trying to keep up appearances, but their money was dwindling away, and the husbands often had their wages cut, and women simply did not know what to do in the sense of they were doing all they could, and what else could they do? And so many looked to Betty Crocker saying, "How about some help here? How about menus that I can create on a very limited budget that still tastes good and that are nutritiously sound?" A lot of women said, I am at wit's end. I don't know what to do. And so Betty Crocker's staff put together very, very elaborate recipe booklets, and also they had demonstrations and gave tips to women on how to prepare meals on Depression era wages. She also took a step in the other direction to sort of let people know about this in a really discreet way in her radio broadcast, where she would bring up a recipe and it sounded fabulous and sounded like something you might want to serve your family, but then she'd also add in that it's economical at the end of it. So it was little things that she did to help women out, but one of the big things was going to Hollywood, and like I mentioned before, and interviewing those Hollywood stars and just to kind of take the mind off the depression. And of course all this changed once World War II began, because the staff at General Mills, or Betty Crocker's staff, shifted the focus completely away from the advertising that we were familiar with before that, that it was selling flour, selling biscuits, selling softest silk, to helping women with ration points, helping them understand the system, helping them to maximize the ration points and to conserve energy and to conserve resources and to save fats. In fact, Betty Crocker became so real that the Office of War Information enlisted Betty Crocker's help. They asked both General Mills and NBC to donate Betty Crocker's time so she could give out these messages to women on the home and home front, because they thought that they'll listen to Betty Crocker. And so she gave all sorts of radio broadcasts and more recipe booklets that gave information about conserving and about shortages and things of that nature. And it was so popular by the end of the war, Fortune magazine called Betty Crocker the second most popular woman in America. And I bet you know who was the most popular.
Eleanor.
Yes, Eleanor Roosevelt.
Of course.
And that's pretty high praise. And yet the same article publicly outed Betty, calling her absolutely fictitious. But, again, it just didn't seem to matter much.
Yeah. Well, you include some examples of her publications through the decades.
Yes.
And it's interesting to see how they approached wartime rationing. Here, for example, they have a recipe in a pamphlet or on a booklet, Casserole of Plenty. You know, you make it sound like it's not something that you can serve to your family, but they will not be deprived.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting the way she, her language is very much like the war era. Like there was a booklet she had called Your Share, where she starts out, every American homemaker who selects food wisely, prepares it carefully, and conserves it diligently is an important link in our national war effort. And at the end of the day, let us be sure we can say, I work for freedom today. I prepared the food. I served with care. I wasted no food this day. Now, that's quite different from, you know, your husband's really going to enjoy this and expect a kiss and a compliment afterwards.
Yeah. Well, in Casserole of Plenty, we have hot milk, butter or margarine, American cheese, breadcrumbs, an egg, parsley, onion, pimento if desired, salt and pepper, of course. In the same pamphlet, there is a recipe for nut burgers.
Yes.
This would be a meatless deal, but it would have plenty of protein in it. Have you attempted any of these recipes?
I did, and it's interesting because I didn't want to at first. I didn't think that they would taste very good because they had very limited ingredients. But I knew that, you know, to be a good researcher, you have to try it out. So I made this service cake. Mm-hmm. With the victory icing, and these recipes are included in the chapter on the war in my book. And I also tried some military cookies. And I was actually surprised by how good they did taste. They were a little drier than I anticipated and less sweet, but it turns out that I kind of liked it because it was less sweet. And they went great with coffee, and you really didn't feel like you were deprived of anything.
Yeah, this was when sugar was a luxury.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, that affected a company that made flour in a big way.
Oh, yeah. Has there been any other advertising character in American history that's been as successful as Betty Crocker?
I would argue that no. I would say there are some good comparisons, but her success is unparalleled. Aunt Jemima, I think, is one that is a really logical one to go to, and she's actually been around longer than Betty Crocker, and she had her own radio show, and at times she was represented by an actual woman, and at times she wasn't. And Yet she didn't. She was not positioned as someone that you would write letters to throughout her history, and someone that would come to you, or that you would come to for advice. And so Betty was certainly not alone. She had an entire sisterhood of other corporate figures, or live trademarks, as they say. And we think of Ann Pillsbury as one of them, and Sue Swanson, and Kay Kellogg. But they did not have the cult of personality that Betty Crocker had. They did not have years and years of a relationship with women, generations upon generations. So when the majority of these sisters came out in the 1950s to compete with Betty, they eventually just faded into obscurity. And today we really only remember Betty and of course, Aunt Jemima.
Mm. In the years following World War II and into the 50s, there was some new things were coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Cake mixes, for example. And when they came out, apparently they were quite controversial.
Yes, and for someone like me who grew up with cake mixes, it may be difficult for me to imagine that these weren't necessarily in every supermarket aisle and in every cupboard. But when cake mixes came out, they actually came out pretty early, but they didn't really start to make an impact until after the war. People didn't love them, and everybody in the business wanted to know why they weren't working out, so they considered the advice of experts. And one psychologist in particular, by the name of Ernest Dichter, said, well, cakes are richly symbolic. It's a gift a woman gives from her inner essence. And if you are to cheapen that by putting it in a box, it really compromises that gift. But if you ask women to crack a couple of eggs, their own fresh eggs, then that will help them feel a greater sense of creative contribution to the cake. And it just so happened that Betty Crocker's cakes did require that you add eggs, and at least almost all of them did. So then General Mills really played that up. They played that up in their advertisements. She had a campaign that went on for what seems like 10 years, where in all of the TV and radio commercials and even in her magazine ads, the tagline of, I guarantee a perfect cake every time you bake cake after cake after cake. And this idea got out there that, you know, you could bake a cake and have success at it, and it was perfectly okay to make it, and your family would accept it, and the other people would accept it. But it was not necessarily the case for everybody. Not everybody was rushing out to buy one of these little boxes of cake mix. In fact, I've heard stories from people telling me that in the 50s, if women were getting together for any event, whether it was bridge or for community work or something of that nature, and someone would bake a cake, someone would inevitably say to that woman, is it scratch or from a mix? And the proper answer was for many, many years, oh, it's from scratch. And if someone were to claim that they did bake it from scratch, you would not be surprised to find someone else digging in the trash to see if there was an empty cake box in there.
Oh, dear. I think the right answer is, I made it myself.
Yes, yeah.
I
think it is, too.
That's, that's being truthful. It's like, you know, somebody being asked, you know, is that who is it that gets asked, is that your hair, Dolly Parton, or those,
yeah,
you know, those are your nails? And she said, yes, they are. I paid for them.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a favorite story or an anecdote about Betty Crocker here to wrap up this afternoon?
Well, I guess I would say that my favorite part of Betty Crocker's legacy are the letters that people sent to her. You know, that was really why I got so interested in Betty Crocker, and I'll read you just an excerpt that's from my book, and it's just a little information of a letter someone sent her to Betty Crocker saying, Dear Betty Crocker, my husband is just about the best man God ever made. He don't smoke, he don't drink, he don't swear, and he don't use bad language, and he don't ever go out without me. But he has a sweet tooth. He likes my cooking and baking and thinks I'm about tops. When he has only one weakness, I'll try to satisfy it.
Hmm.
Do you have time for another one?
Sure. I'm thinking that wife, Betty Crocker, should have written back, make devil's food cake for this man. Okay, one more.
This one woman was not convinced that a way to a man's heart was through the stomach, so she writes, Betty Crocker, my advice is for women looking for a man, if you want your husband to be crazy, she goes on to say, if you want your husband to be crazy over you, just doll up, treat him rough, and give him nothing. I've seen this work out too many times to believe anything different.
Do we know how Betty responded?
We don't. Wouldn't that be interesting to know?
Yeah, that's a shame. Well, Susan, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. It's been fun talking with you about Betty Crocker.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Sure. Susan Marks has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Finding Betty Crocker, The Secret Life of America's First Lady of Food. The publisher of Finding Betty Crocker, Simon & Schuster. Our guest Susan Marks will be in the Chicago area next week on Tuesday, April 19th. At noon on Tuesday, she'll be in Winnetka at the bookstall at noon for a program called Lunch and Learn. And then later in the day at 7:30 in the evening, she'll be in Oak Brook at Borders Books and Music for an event there. Meet and greet, book signing, no doubt. Finding Betty Crocker, The Secret Life of America's First Lady of Food. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, and settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade on this Thursday afternoon, futures finished the day like this, with the soft red winter wheat May contract down a penny and a half today. Had a high of $3.11 a bushel, a low at $3.07.5, a settlement price at $3.09. Once again, that May contract in the soft red winter wheat pit at the Chicago Board of Trade a penny and a half lower for the day. July futures down 2.25, $3.20. The high, the low at $3.16.5, settled $3.18.25. Down 2.25. That's your harvest month. September futures at 327 high, low at 324.5. Settlement price there at $3.25. They were off 2 cents as well. December and March off 2 cents for the day in the wheat pit as well. 337.5 the high for the December contract, the low at 334.5, and a settlement price at 35 cents even. March contract at 344.25 high, low at $3.42.5. And a settlement price for the March 2006 soft red winter wheat at $3.42.5, down 2 cents for the day. From the corn pit, corn up 2 cents in the nearby May contract, 209 the high, the low at 205.5, settled at 205.75. Once again, that was up 2 for the day. July futures a penny and 3/4 higher, 217.25 the high, the low at 14.25, settled on that low at $2.14 for the July corn, a penny and 3/4 higher. September futures, 224.25 the high, the low at $2.21, settled 221.25, up 1.5 in the December contract. Your new crop, 233 the high, low at 230.25, settled on the low, up 1.5 for the day. March futures now 240, the high for the day, the low at 237.25. March corn for 2006 settled on the low at 237.25, they were up 1.5, and the May futures were up a penny and a quarter at 241.25 for next year, with a high of 43.75 and a low at 42 cents even. From the oat pit, the nearby May contract, a 158 high, the low at 156.5, settled 156.75. They were down a penny and a quarter. And July oats, 156, the high, the low at 154.5. Settlement price at 154.75, down a penny and a quarter for the day. Soy complex now, bean futures down between 5 and 7 cents today. Wire Services reporting that a lot of hedging action coming out of South America. That's kind of an interesting turn of events, and especially at $6.17 a bushel in the nearby May contract, probably where they're hedging at, down 6 and a quarter at 626 and a half high for the May, the low at 616, the settlement price at 617. Once again, that May soybean contract settled at 617, down 6.25. We'll take that issue up for just a bit when we talk this afternoon with Dan Zwicker of Agribiser Services out of Bloomington, Illinois, about the marketplace. July futures in the bean pit now, down 7 cents for the day, 633. On the high, the low at 622, settled a penny above that at $6.23, off 7, the August off 7 as well. 621, the settlement price there, with a high of 29.5 and a low at $6.20 even. Once again, the August contract, a $6.21 settlement price, down 7 cents. September futures, 618.5 the high, the low at 611, settled on that low, down 4 cents. And the November futures, your new crop, 613.5 the high, the low at 604.5. Settled $6.06. They were down 4 for the day. January soybeans off a nickel, 614 the high, the low at 607. Settled on that low, down 5 cents at 607 for the January 2006 soybeans. Bean meal in the products now, 191.20 in the nearby May contract. The high, the low at 187.80. Settlement price at $188.30. They were down a dollar even. Maybean meal, $192.30 the high, the low at $188.70. Settled $189.10. They were off one even as well. And the oil contracts now, $22.57 for the nearby Maybean oil. On the high, the low at $22.37. Settlement price at $22.42. They were down 13. And July bean oil, $22.76 the high, the low at $22.53. A settlement price there at $22.60. And that was down 22 cents. Hey, it's Ag Policy Radio Day all the way through April and May on Thursdays, or at least a few of the Mays in Thursday. We'll be talking about ag policy and inviting your phone calls. This afternoon, we'll take up World Trade Organization with the Gardner Chair of Agricultural Policy here at the University of Illinois, Bob Thompson. That'll start about 20:25 after the hour, coming up in the closing market report. We hope you will join us then, and we look forward to hearing from you and taking your questions. Celeste Quinn is here now with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, Todd, it was a higher day today for cattle. Lean hogs and maybellies finished lower. April feeder cattle, 109.55, the high 109.15, the low 109.30, the settlement, that up 35. May, 106.75, the high 106.15, the low 106.25, the settlement, that up 45. August feeder cattle, 108.32 and a half, the high 107.75, the low 107.77 and a half, the settlement, that up 15. April live cattle, 90.17 and a half, the high 89.70, the low, the settlement 89.92 and a half, that up 90. June live cattle, 85.20, the high 84.65, the low 84.85, the settlement, that up 57. April lean hog, 69.92 and a half, the high 69.60, the low, the settlement 69.67 and a half, down 15. May, 75.60, the high 74.55, the low 75.35, the settlement, that down 27 and a half. June 77.60, the high 76.35, the low, the settlement 77.25, that down 7 and a half. July lean hog 77.90, the high 76.57 and a half, the low, finishing at 77.57 and a half, that down 32 and a half cents. May bellies 88.40, the high 85.65, the low 85.87 and a half, the settlement, that finishing down $2.37 and a half. The Dow is off 81 points at 10,323. The NASDAQ down 20 at 1954. The S&P 500 off 8 points at 1166.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, helping to create a storehouse of possibilities and products from a single seed. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Robert Perez from Providence, Rhode Island writes, Dear Dr. Science, where can I buy a Bunsen burner for my daughter's science project?
Bunsen burners are a restricted